This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers, as always. This week we have two sponsors, MindVault, your personal memorization assistant, which is available at mindvaultapp.com, and BDoc's Timeline 3D is back again, one of the best applications for building interactive timelines that can present time-based information in a 3D format, available on the App Store as well. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's a great week. We are coming back from a holiday yesterday. It was Martin Luther King Day, okay. And so we had the day off. So it's weird. Some schools around here closed and others don't. I know some of our schools that are near us have probably a third of their students are boarders, where they actually live on campus and you know, obviously their parents live in other cities. And so they usually don't close on days like today, because then that's just an excuse for kids to get into trouble.
Yeah. Keep them busy.
Yeah, so it was nice. We have off for Christmas, and then about 2 weeks later, we get another day off. So then here in another few weeks, we'll get a four-day weekend for President's Day. Nice. I'm not even sure what that's for, but I will gladly take it.
Yeah, we don't have a Prime Minister's Day in the UK.
Well, what's funny is it's celebrating the birthday of Lincoln and Washington, the first and the 16th presidents, but that's not even their birthdays. And so I'm very unsure why we get those days off when we get them. And we call it a winter break a lot too. I always know it's always special to me, because that is always the anniversary of when we swapped over to Google Apps. We did it over President's Day weekend. That way I would have like an extra day for any kind of changes. So we switched in 2010, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so this will be our third anniversary of Google Apps.
Awesome. Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Well, over here, what are we up to? Not a whole lot, I guess. We're about to start prelim exams with our senior kids. So those are like kind of practice exams for the real thing coming up in end of April, beginning of May. And one of my jobs in that is to run the digital exams. So kids in our school who have any kind of additional needs of whatever type have the right to request a digital version of the exam. Which the way it's done in Scotland is it's just a PDF form of the printed exam paper, and we do that on the iPad. We did that last year, and we're doing it again this year. And the way we do that at the moment is that we use PDF Expert, and we have a special configuration profile that just turns everything off, and we blacklist its MAC address from the Wi-Fi and all this kind of stuff. So it really is very much a standalone computer. Very little you can do with it. And I'll load on the PDFs, and the kids will sit in the exam, and we give them a keyboard in that case, but they only optionally use it. Some kids use it, some kids don't. And they type their answers where other kids write their answers. And at the end, you're supposed to print out the paper and send it off with everybody else. So that's my job for the next couple of weeks. That's running through the school. So that's good fun. Yeah. Worked very well for us.
Yeah, I guess that your Aerohive network makes that pretty easy to kind of blacklist those. And thankfully, you probably don't have any students that are savvy enough to start spoofing MAC addresses and things like that. I guess from an iPad, you really couldn't do that as easily.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting thing, though. At the moment, last year we had Apple Wi-Fi equipment, so that was a case of going around and blacklisting the same MAC addresses from 9 different base stations separately, which was a little bit of a pain. Obviously, with the Aerohive controller, cloud controller Wi-Fi, that's a lot easier to do. But the way we're going to do this next year, actually, once we're in iOS 6, is we're going to use Guided Access to do that. So, in fact, what I do at the moment is I have a number of... I use all the stock of spare iPads that we have in the school, which is about 4. Fortunately, we don't have more than 4 kids in any one exam that need an iPad. But once we get onto iOS 6 and get into Guided Access, we would be able to actually use their own iPad in the exam, because we would be able to guarantee that it was locked into specifically one application. And even then, we would be able to prevent them from moving around inside the application as well. So that's pretty secure. And it would just take us, you know, half an hour to prep that ahead of the exam.
Yeah, Guided Access, I think, will be one of those features that really is going to be used for a whole lot more than it was intended to, because you can even outside of education, think about maybe a hotel check-in system that they could, yep. You know, that you could build a kiosk for the iPad and then basically set it up once and then you're good to go. So yeah, it's, of course it requires iOS 6. So, does it help you this year?
Yeah, it doesn't help us this year, but, that future will come. We've also been doing a little bit more work in our refresh and having some conversations around how we're going to deploy apps. Now, I think we might actually keep that discussion for another show because I think it deserves a certain amount of exploration because these techniques change all the time. And the techniques for deploying, I mean, I've heard about these techniques. You know, Apple talks about the layered model and the personal model and the institutional model. And what I understood about them a year ago is different from what I understand about them today and the way I think about what makes the most sense and, you know, what's the easiest to administer and so on. It's actually kind of evolving as my understanding and getting more into actually having to deploy this for real in about 6 months' time. So we'll hang on to that one for another show, but I think that's an interesting consideration to have because the results of that are not always what you think they are. It seems obvious that one particular approach is going to be the cheapest, most efficient or whatever, and typically it's actually there's a little more to it than that.
Yeah, it's an ever-evolving model, and I don't even know that there's a one size this works for this, you know, for every school, certain just depending on the school's culture, the age, the, you know, obviously, and even with your ages, certain students, you know, sections of students, you probably will do things a little differently. But yeah, that's a you know, again, it's great that we even have the things like the volume purchase program and things like that as options. You know, again, it's just drastically different from the old desktop days.
Yeah, very different, very different. And you typically weren't buying that much content for your computers in the old days as well. You know, it was, you know, the content came through the web browser and, you know, a CD-ROM, you know, it was a physical thing that you passed around if you wanted to look at content, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're some of our old PCs in our classroom, like the Weave, that they just, a lot of those are very, very old. They're all getting replaced with iPads this next school year. They're mainly used for our reading comprehension advanced reader program. It's basically just a glorified web terminal. But some of our very, our K-3 and K-4, which is our 3 and 4 year old kindergarten, some of their curriculum it came with a disc. Well, that they've been using that curriculum for, you know, a number of years now. Well, and those discs are, you know, some of those are still like for Windows 98. And so they try to use those, and we have a real time trying to use those because even though they're running Windows XP, which is, again, is over 10 years old, they're trying to use Windows 98 disk. And so it kind of, you know, and I'm trying to explain to the teacher, well, that's, you know, we can't guarantee that's going to work and certainly not going to work after the school year. And, you know, it's, that's a whole nother issue.
These are the challenges, you know, when you start to mix up code and content together, that can certainly get tricky. Something I've definitely started to put my eye on a little bit more in the past 6 months to a year, you know, what I want to spend my money on, what I want to make sure is still available in time to come. Hard to know.
Yeah. Before we get started, I guess let's take a quick sponsor break. Thank MindVault for sponsoring the show this week. MindVault, they've been with us. This will be the third week. Noah Reed's a developer. He's a great guy to follow on app.net on Twitter. He has a lot of interesting things to say. It's a personal memorization assistant. Allows you to memorize any passage of text. So you got things like lines from a play, Shakespeare. This would be studying for a test. You're trying to memorize a poem. Trying to memorize quotes that you can use in, say, a debate, scriptures, wedding vows, really anything you're trying to memorize. When I tweet the links, I usually post a link to the sponsor's Twitter page as well. Had somebody respond that is a full-time Mac trainer out in Birmingham, Alabama, and he's also going to school as well, and he's like, this is perfect for my school. This is perfect for some of the things I do. Again, it's just a couple dollars on the App Store. Allows you to, you know, input what you're wanting to remember, and then as you can move a slider to, you know, show more or less of the passage to try to test how you're memorizing it. It's available for the iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. It's at mindvaultapp.com, or again, just search for MindVault in the App Store. Recently was the App of the Week on geekwire.com. We'll have a link to that and to mindvaultapp.com in the show notes. But thanks for them for sponsoring the show this week. And again, follow Noah on Twitter. It's at Noah Reed. I'll have a link to him in the show notes. Great guy to follow on Twitter as well.
Awesome. Yeah. So our topic for this week is going to be about teachers' professional development going into some kind of one-to-one program. And I guess this comes out of, we thought about doing this show a little while back, and I've been involved recently in going to some other schools and helping them do a little bit of that as well. And it kind of caused me to reflect on how did we do it a couple of years ago, and what has anything changed, or is it just, are the basic principles the same as they always were? So there's a good range of things to talk about in here. I think there's technical professional development, and there's you know, the teaching practice that has to evolve and stuff as well. So let's just dig into that, Bradley. What'd you say?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. So I guess let's kick off talking about technical professional development, because I think one of the things that I've seen over the past couple of years is that teachers have just dramatically upped their game in terms of their capabilities. And I think it's also true to say that the computer has kind of upped its game as well in terms of being easy to use. So whereas before there was quite a substantial gulf between even who I consider to be our sophisticated computer users, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and where the computers were in terms of the complexity and the maintenance that they required and the understanding. And as the computers have gotten easier, the teachers have kind of come the other way. And it seems to me now that that gap is much, much narrower than it was even a few years ago. So I guess that one of the things that we've seen happen is that whereas it used to be that teachers would, you know, if a dialogue box came up on the screen, for example, teachers would like phone me up or call me through and say, could you explain this to me? You know, and now what we have found is that teachers can now start to take even like frontline tech support problems. You know, they may not always want to, they may not always have time to, but you know, what I find is that the kind of questions that come back to me now as the tech guy in the school are much, much deeper and more complicated problems than ever before. You know, so it usually tends to be, you know, there's genuinely something broken with my iPad rather than there's a thing on the screen, and even though I can read English, I can't read that English, you know. So that's something I've seen happen. It's something that I think we should expect of teachers, that in this world where, you know, technology is just, it's just the basics of life now. It's not something that only a tiny fraction of the population are into. I think it's right that we should expect a bit more from our teachers. And I'm not saying we should expect our teachers to be tech support, because I don't think that's true. But I think we should expect to see a greater confidence, because the computers have gotten easier, right? So it's time for people to come the other way a little bit and be more confident, because like I say, I often say that when I go to other schools, I say, I challenge you guys with your new iPads to try and break the operating system. And, you know, then I leave the building and leave that problem to the guy who's behind me. But it's been very, very rare that that's happened. So that's an important thing to think about to start with, is how can you expect teachers to move along with you?
Yeah, I agree with you. Just as our teachers expect our students to not always know the answer to all their questions, you know, on day one, but they expect them to put the time in to maybe think about the answer, to brainstorm over the answer. We should really expect our teachers to be that way with technology. You know, they may not know the answer to all their questions day one, but, you know, something I encourage our teachers to do before you ask me how to do something and say, you know, your favorite, you know, Microsoft Office application, Google it. You're trying to teach them, because I don't know it right offhand generally, but try to teach them how to find the answers. And of course, one thing that I think helps us is, and I don't know how the makeup at your school is, but I would say all but say 5 or 6 of our staff members now are carrying iPhones. So, you know, if I say the word iCloud in the faculty meeting, most people have a general understanding of what I might be talking about. Where if I'd have said MobileMe 4 years ago or .Mac 4 years ago, no one would have known what I was talking about. So, you know, that really comes down to that shared OS between the phone and the iPad. It's kind of giving people a teaser on how to use these devices. So if we've got an app that's messing up, not working right, a teacher knows, well, okay, let's double tap the home button and actually force quit it. Where if I have a Mac app that's frozen, most teachers don't know how to get to the force quit menu.
Yeah, it's not quite so obvious. I think you're totally right about that, you know, smartphones and smart device, touchscreen devices and so on have become such a kind of part of the culture. They're almost like, you know, this decade's iPod. You know, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, people knew what an iPod was and they knew what an MP3 player was. And now people understand what smartphones are and what tablets are. And I think I've said this before, I'm sure, on the show, that my kind of barometer for whether people will know what I'm talking about is to go to an airport. I'm traveling somewhere and just look at the devices people are using, because airports are such a cross-section of a large part of society that what I see nowadays is it strikes me like how weird it is to see somebody with a laptop open in an airport terminal. It's kind of jarring to see that. And years ago, that was a perfectly common thing. Let's get practical about this. How do we help teachers come in to an iPad world? Now, I guess what we've just said is important. You have to gauge this based on, like, take the temperature of the staff, right? If they are, 90% iPhone and Android users, they're going to have a good idea where to start. Whereas if your staff are, they're on feature phones, they don't even have a phone, they've never seen a tablet, they're not common, typically computer users, you may have to start at the very basics. And in recent days, I've done both. I've tried to take people from being iPhone users to being iPad teachers, and I've also done sessions where I start with, this is the power button. You press it for 3 seconds to turn on the iPad and so on. So it's really, really important to start at the right level when it comes to introducing people to the technology. At the same time, I think it's important that you have to expect people's confidence to grow, right? So they are going to be very unconfident the first time, and then you will, hopefully, if you're teaching right, you will grow and grow and grow that. Now, I wanted to give you a couple of practical places to start to get people to where you need them to be. And I think number one, this is above and beyond anything else, is you've got to get people set up properly on the device and then set up properly with the App Store. Now, what I mean by set up properly with the device is you want to really make sure that people have an individual Apple ID. The days in which when we used to be able to share an Apple ID, I think are, if not already at an end, then definitely coming to an end quite soon. I'm not saying it's going to be made impossible. I'm just saying that as the evolution of the platform goes on, it's going to be less and less, or more and more inconvenient, I think is what I want to say about that. So as more sync services come in, as iCloud becomes pervasive, having that mingled in with somebody else's device is going to be very problematic. So set up the Apple ID correctly. Second thing is explicitly take your time to build people's familiarity with the App Store and their confidence in installing software. Because for people who've never thought about computers before, which is, let's face it, pretty few people in professional positions like teaching, people who have had computers before will probably have been burned at one time or another by installing software on their PC. Because, you know as well as I do, Bradley, that's one of the best ways to destroy your PC or your Mac. Yeah. Maybe not so much your Mac anymore now that we've got the Mac App Store, but, for many, many years, people who are relatively senior now, their careers advanced with computers, there were many, many years when installing software was an incredibly precarious process. And a lot of people are quite scared to do it now. But what I take my time to do is always say, look, this is the App Store. This is how you install software. This is how you delete software. And once you do that, the iPad is just like it was.
It's a kind of interesting talking about software delivery models. I had a perfect example of that about an hour before the show started. I had a staff member that said, hey, do we have Adobe Acrobat on our computers? And I asked her, well, no, we have Preview. It's built into the Mac, so it's a great lightweight PDF viewer. Why are you asking? Well, and she had a PDF that she needed to edit, and they said, well, you have to use Adobe Acrobat Reader on the Mac to do that. So, and she had already left for the day, and so I emailed her back a link to download it, and I kind of prefaced this, are you still here? Do you need help installing this? And I think that, again, it's not that it was hard. I'm sure it was just a package file that, you run through there and answer the questions positively, but that's really where the iOS App Store has kind of taken us. You could send a teacher an App Store link and have full confidence that he or she can download it with no issues.
I think it's really, really difficult to overstate how important that is to the changes that we're seeing, around apps and software in general. I can't even find the words to describe it, but it's like installing software is a recreational activity now for people. You know, it used to be a thing that was terrorizing people, and now it's something people do for entertainment and fun. And, you know, this has been a thing we've talked about several times. Like, this is a real mass market movement. It's not just the geeks who are installing software for fun. It's everybody. It's, you know, old people, it's young people, it's busy people, it's, you know, highly educated people, you know, very ordinary people in the street. Everybody's installing software now, and that's a really big deal.
It's as easy at this point as downloading a CD or downloading an album. And you think about it, and of course, you know, us being our Mac nerds, we think this is so easy. But think about the process a novice Mac user, novice computer user goes when he or she wants to download, say, Adobe Reader. So they click the link. And then depending on their settings, it'll download to the downloads folder, but they don't even know that it finished because it went into that kind of window in Safari 6 where we don't even see it. So then they say, okay, well, they think they've installed it. Well, no, you then have to go and double click that file. And if it's a disk image, then you have to know to drag that to the applications folder. But if it's a package file, it's a PKG, you double click it and you go through all the wizard and ask you where you want to install it. And I just tell people to answer positively. And then after that, you're still not even sure where the application is. And again, all that makes sense to you and I, but just somebody that has never really installed a lot of software, they don't know. And it just, you're right. We cannot overstate how easy this is, because let's say this was an iPad and she needed the official version of Adobe Reader. So she's going to go to the App Store. She's going to install it. Then she's going to go to the email that has the PDF. She's going to click the open in, and then she's going to say Adobe Reader.
Yep. Yep. That's huge. I mean, do you remember, I think I mentioned last week I was going to be helping a friend migrate from his Emac G4 to his new 2012 iMac. Well, I did that at the weekend, and it was a fun experience because, you know, it was back on Tiger for the first time in years and all that kind of stuff, and just remembering the way things used to be. But one of the things he said to me during that conversation, he was quite nervous that he was not going, he felt like he was very far behind the state of the art, and he was right in that. You know, he was running 10.4.2 or something, and you know, lots and lots of things that happened in the Mac world since then had passed him by. And the thing that he kind of grabbed onto to bring himself, like, intellectually into a mountain lion world was Launchpad on the Mac. And his wife had an iPad. She had an iPad for a couple of years. And he said, well, I've seen this thing where you click on the space rocket and it's just like an iPad. And now I know I'm not out of my depth. And that was, it was fascinating to me that was the thing that he hooked on, was that the Mac was, there was a bit on the Mac that looked like an iPad, and that was what he could cope with to get himself into this world. And I'm sure he'll you know, take off from there, but that was just an interesting little aside that he made to me during that whole process that we were working on.
Yeah, I was anxiously following your tweets about that. The iPhoto was the most interesting one, that you had to migrate the library and then let it import the library.
Yeah, it turns out there's a tool on apple.com support site where I think he was maybe running iPhoto 4 or maybe 2, but it was certainly a pre-iPhoto 5 version. And his library wasn't the package file. It was the loose folder library structure that iPhoto used to have. And we copied that over, no problem. But then it said, you've got to prepare this library before you can migrate it. So there was a tool to download from Apple. We downloaded that, ran it on his library, and then that basically turned it into a package file, and then we were able to open that in the current iPhoto and migrate it up to the latest version. So, and it worked perfectly. It just, you know, took 20 minutes to do or whatever, but it worked flawlessly, and it was pretty great. And his iTunes library came over perfectly well and all that kind of stuff. So actually, in the end, it wasn't very painful. I didn't bother migrating his Apple Works user folder. that was, although I could probably still use that in my teaching. I don't know, because we still have to cover that. But what can I say? It was fascinating. It really was. You know, it's just to see how far we've come. And the thing that he commented on hardware-wise was he couldn't believe how quiet the iMac was compared to the eMac, which just has fans blazing the whole time. It was really... Quit. Everybody should have to do that once in 10 years or something.
What's he doing with the old eMac?
I think he's probably just going to erase the hard drive and then dispose of it. There's a recycling center not far from where we both live, so I don't think there's a computer museum nearby that would take it from him.
It's people like that are the reason that we still have to cover CRTs on the Apple hardware certification exam. I mean, it's a big section is disposing of CRTs. And, of course, you're sitting there in the class thinking, why are we talking about this? There shouldn't be any CRTs on the market, but clearly there still are some Emacs. Of course, when I came to work here, we still had some old Emacs in the library. And if I had a bigger office, I would like to, say, have like a little conference table than just have one of them sitting there just for kicks.
It's hard to remember just how big those things were as well. You know, that was the other thing that he pointed out to me was, look how much more desk space I've got now. And he's got this razor-thin Mac, which is, you know, it's a beautiful machine. It's the first time I've seen one. I just could not get over it. It was like a piece of sculpture or something. It really was fantastic. So anyway, we are so far off topic already. That's fantastic. The next thing, the App Store was obviously a big deal. And the next thing that teachers often have a hump to get over is using the virtual keyboard. I'm still pretty convinced that this is quite a generational thing. It's not something that I see kids spontaneously bringing a lot of keyboards to school. I've seen it happen occasionally. We obviously make use of it in programming class because we're using so many symbols, but don't commonly see it with other subjects. But I always take a lot of time to get people over their understanding of the virtual keyboard. So the first thing I often do is just say, look, let's just type something, you know, and just trying it and practicing with it is actually really important. And that gets a lot of people a long way, is just sit down and type some stuff on this keyboard and you'll get the hang of it. But then there's always obviously other things that are less than intuitive about it. And in particular, things like, you know, the apostrophe trick where you swipe up on the comma key to get an apostrophe and so on the home screen. Little tricks like that. And also for any teachers who might teach modern languages of some kind, if you show them how to type accented characters on the iPad keyboard, they just fall in love with it straight away, because it's so much easier than trying to understand dead keys on the Mac as used to be before Lion. So those are some of the things that we do with new teachers, is just have them practice with the keyboard and help them get over some of those, assumptions that there's no way that this can work sort of thing, even though... you know, lots and lots of people are doing it fine. And what we find is that once people do get over that sort of intellectual barrier towards the keyboard, they do get on fine, you know, and they just go ahead and start typing, and that seems to work. The thing that goes along with that, and the thing that I see a lot of people missing out when they start to teach about the keyboard, is to teach about text selection, right? So some of the tricks you can do for text selection, such as double tapping a word, using the insertion point, doing select, and what's the edit menu all about on iOS? I think that's something that's worth definitely mentioning as well at some point. A little black bar that has cut, copy, paste, and various other, you know, define, suggest, and how does the autocorrect work, and things like that. Those are very useful things to go over as well.
Yeah, I feel like that once you can kind of nail that cut, copy, paste, that you become much faster with just general day-to-day usage of iOS. If that's still tricky for you, then that really can really slow you down. I'd almost love to see some sort of like app that can help, like, you know, train you on that. I don't know how that'd be possible, but
there's a good app called Tap Typing, which is there's a free version in the App Store. There's a paid version as well, and it's the kind of, it's not like Mavis Beacon, but it's a typing training or program. But it is explicitly designed for the touch keyboard. So, for example, it doesn't do things like rest your fingers on the keys, right? Because obviously you don't want to rest your fingers on the keys when it's a touchscreen keyboard. But I met the developer of that app a while back, and he's done a great job of building something that is pretty useful for people who struggle to get over that hump. Tap Typing is the name of that app. It's pretty useful.
I'll have a link for that on the show notes.
Yeah. Really, from a technical point of view, those are the two main things. And then there's a little, I want to say, a hack you can do with people. I don't think hack is the right word, but one of the things that we found was very useful with our teachers was to just give them some reason to pick up the iPad in the morning. And what we did there was I helped everybody set up their school email and their school calendar on their iPad. And that was a way that they could pick up and send email from the device. And it was a reason to pick it up in the morning was to see what's going on with email, what's going on with the calendar and so on. So that's a good trick to do as well. Just get them set up with their calendar. And you may or may not want to help people migrate their personal calendars to iCloud or something like that. We obviously didn't do that at the time because there was no iCloud, and I didn't want to get into... I didn't feel that I could advocate for people adopting mobile me at the time. I guess we spent more time back then talking about Gmail, getting your Gmail account set up, getting your Google Calendar set up and so on. But giving people some kind of reason to pick up the device in the morning is really, really useful.
Yeah, I agree. The more folks, you know, start to pick it up and use it, the more they're going to, you know, kind of reach for it. So, you know, if they're used to checking their email on there, maybe that'll kind of spur them, you know, when they need to type up a document, that they'll grab their iPad instead of going to the desktop, you know, computer at home. It just, the more it can become top of mind that this is a computer, this isn't just, you know, a reader, an e-reader, that is good.
Yeah, and the trick, I think, for guys like you and I and people in the IT department is to model that practice to teachers, right? Because that's what we do as teachers all the time. Is we, you know, I stand up in front of a class and I try to show them how I use technology to kind of benefit me and help my learning and stuff like that. And I think it's important for us to do that for our colleagues as well. You know, if they see us always running back to our laptop and so on, you know, that gives the wrong message. It says that this iPad can't handle all the tasks that we needed to do. Now, of course, there are going to be times where you do have to go back to your laptop and do certain things. But, you know, the way I've always tried to approach technology deployments and whatever technology I'm going to advocate that we use is I'm always the first guy head first into it, right? So I'm the guy who's only got an iPad mini now, for example. And I'm living with an iPad mini and I'm trying to understand that device. And I'm showing people that I'm doing it as well, you know, so it's not like, here's a device for you and I'm getting something better or more powerful. It's I'm with you. I'm doing the same things you do. I've been on this road before you. I know what the pitfalls are going to be. So here's how you can follow me and learn from me on that. And I think that's incredibly powerful. You know, even if you don't explicitly come out and say those things, but just to show the way you work with your colleagues that you're on board with this as well is really, really, really powerful. Do you want to do another sponsor at the point?
Bradley? Yeah, let's go ahead and think of our next sponsor. BDocs Timeline 3D, they've been with us for a few months now, really great supporters of the show, specifically talking about their iOS app today. Again, $14.99 in the App Store, or if you're in the volume purchase program and you're purchasing 20 or more, you get it half off. So it's BDocs Timeline 3D for iOS. It lets teachers and students create and present timelines on the iPad, an iPhone, and an iPod Touch. Timeline, you know, this app is great in a history class, but it's also great in pretty much any class, whether it be a Spanish class, whether it be a Bible class, whether it be an English class. There's all sorts of uses. For example, the guys over at BDocs had a classroom of students in France who worked together to build a multimedia timeline of major events in World War II. The students included historical images and video clips, which they found in their research, as well as narrations that the students recorded themselves. Timelines begin as a standard 2D chart, and then they can shift to a 3D flyover effect with a click of a button. Again, this app works great with AirPlay, with a, you know, television or a projector. It's deadly powerful, but deadly simple. And to me, that's kind of the hallmark of iOS. You can do things that are really powerful, but you can pretty much pick up the app and figure out, you know, kind of the basics within just a few minutes. Of course, that's one of the things with me that makes the iPad so powerful is the camera and the microphone. So if you're out and want to narrate kind of how, you know, your school property does in the throughout the four seasons, you can take pictures as the school year goes along, record what you see, record the temperatures, and do it all right from the app. You know, we're talking about not going back to your Mac. You can do all this right from the iPad app. So again, that's BDocs Timeline 3D for iOS. We'll have a link to those guys in the show. It's BDocs.com. BEEDOCS.com, $14.99 single purchase, or through the volume purchase program, it's half off. So BDoc's Timeline 3D for iOS. Thanks for those guys for sponsoring the show.
Indeed. Thanks, guys. So second part of this conversation, I think, is more towards the teaching practice, the pedagogy that we're going to talk about in terms of helping teachers develop with iPad. And really what I want to do in this little bit of discussion is, there's lots to say about this, but there's a couple of ways. We're talking about ways to get started and for teachers going into a program like this. And one of the things I want to promote to people is a framework for technology adoption that's called SAMR. Now, SAMR is an acronym, S-A-M-R. And it's something we've used with various schools and various groups over the past couple of years to help them understand how they can approach technology. Because I think one of the things that happens sometimes, you go to iPad education events or whatever, is that people always want to kind of wow you with the best thing they've done on the iPad. And for some people, that's really inspirational, right? That really high-level, totally transformational approach to using technology in the classroom is very, very inspirational. And that gets some people fired up. But it can also close other people down. And I think one of the things that you have to pitch very carefully is, what are you going to do with this thing in the classroom? And the SAMR model is used very extensively, I guess, and we certainly use it all the time, to talk about steps towards doing something transformational in the classroom. So here's my sort of 5-minute understanding of SAMR. The four steps: S stands for substitution, A stands for augmentation, M stands for modification, and R stands for redefinition. And let me give you just one line about what each of these means. Substitution, to start with, means taking something analog and replacing it with something digital. So, for example, instead of writing an essay, we type an essay. That's it. Augmentation is substitution with some kind of functional enhancement. So we can now type our essay and we can spell check and grammar check. Okay? Those are below a certain level that we talk about, the transformational level. The subsequent two, the M stage, the modification stage, and the redefinition stage, are what the author of this framework terms transformational. And modification is about redesigning the task a little bit to take into account the technology that you have. So instead of just writing an essay, we could create a newsletter, or create, a flyer or something like that, or even start to use different media. So instead of it being a written work, it could be a work of video or something like that. And then redefinition is a step beyond that, where you've basically completely redesigned the task to take into account the technology that's available to you. So instead of writing an essay, perhaps, you shoot a film and do something like that. Now, that's just an example. That's not to say that in every case you've got to shoot a film instead of writing an essay. The essays certainly still have their place. But the point being that, and because you have this technology in your hands, you can start to reach for things that were previously inconceivable in the classroom. For example, go back 25 years and think about trying to make a film and distribute it to the entire world. Completely impossible, right? For a school. And one of the things that I've seen when I see things that are kind of redefinition and transformational is that it often involves the internet, right? So it involves talking to audiences, it involves reaching out to people beyond the school and things like that. But also it involves doing things that were previously possible, right? They were conceivable. You could think about how you might do them, but you never did them because they were too slow, too expensive, took too long to set up, required too much space in the classroom, anything like that. So the framework SAMR, S-A-M-R, the thing that if you're going to look into this, there's an iTunes U course called As We May Teach, where the author of the framework, a man called Dr. Ruben Puntadera, he has a number of videos in that collection where he talks about the application of the SAMR model. But I think one of the really important things to get across about that model is that it's not a grading framework for teachers' performance. Because one of the things that can sometimes happen is when you talk about, is this transformational, is this just substitution, people who are only doing substitution can get a bit discouraged again and say, well, I'm just a substitution teacher, blah, blah, blah. But the key point with SAMR is that it's kind of like Ruben described it as like a ladder where you can take steps, you know, and if you aim for redefinition and you don't get there, well, okay, you've done something pretty substantially modified anyway. But it's a framework for progression. Rather than a framework for saying who's the most modification teacher, who's the most redefining teacher in the school. You don't want to use it that way. You want to use it in a way that you can say, well, here's how you start, and explicitly say it's okay to start at this level. Because quite often, without any kind of conversation like this, teachers often feel that on the first day they're going to be expected to do something involving, you know, shooting a video and putting it on YouTube. And that's not really the way that I think anybody's going to approach it. But, you know, start with, let's just type our essay this week or this month or this year. All we're going to do is type essays, and then next year we'll do something else. You know, I would hope it might be the improvement cycle might be a little shorter than 1 year, but, you know, it gives people a way to be confident that they can progress through these kind of things.
No, I agree with you. And that's the advice I've given to a lot of schools when they come and visit us and they say, you know, we have all this new technology, but we don't have a plan. And so I tell them, just do one thing. Say this, I'm going to do one new thing electronically or digitally that I used to do analog or with a piece of paper this week. You know, just pick one. And then say, okay, this semester I'm going to do 8 or I'm going to do 10. And just set yourself a goal and then achieve that goal. And what's great, you know, especially in teaching, is you generally are teaching largely the same curriculum every year. So you make some changes this month or this year or this semester. Well, you don't have to remake those next year. It's just part of your curriculum. So as you continually make improvements every year and move more and more to a digital curriculum, you know, before you know it, in a few years, you have transformed your classroom.
Yeah, and that's a really important thing as well, is that particularly for schools who are coming from non-Apple platforms to iPad, it's a very useful thing to say, look, you can bring your existing stuff with you. And then as you design new things, you can design them with the assumption that you have all of this stuff in mind. So we're in that exact position right now where a lot of our secondary teachers have brought along PDFs, Word documents, PowerPoints from our existing curriculum. And as of August of this year, we're going to be teaching a new curriculum that we're going to have to develop a lot of resources for. But now we have an opportunity to start and say, well, now I can design this course with the fact that I've got one-to-one iPads in the classroom, I've got iTunes U available to me, I've got iBooks Author, I've got Book Creator on the iPad, I've got, you know, whatever it is that you want to use. When a change comes, that's when you want to be ready to move on and redesign your stuff with the idea that you have this technology in your hand. It's really not necessary, and it's important to emphasize that it's not necessary to spend hours converting all your stuff into some mythical Apple format that you have to have, because you don't have to have it in large part. Having said that, I did once get up in front of a crowd of teachers, and one guy put his hand up and said, I've got 10,000 flash animations for biology, what are you going to do for me? And I said, sir, you've got a problem no matter what platform you move to. Unless you stick with Windows, I guess.
I just got a tweet not too long ago that said, hey, what's the best? It's my rep for my ISP. And she said, what's the best app on the iPad to open Flash? And I do not think I have enough characters on Twitter to respond to that accurately. That will probably be an email.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to say nothing, because there are some third-party browsers that could do it. But I would rather just say, you know, not available.
Yeah, can you find a workaround that involves not having to do that?
You're right, yeah. You find a workaround, not the platform.
Yeah. What I said to that guy was, like, you know, your school's talking to go to mobile devices, and there's no mobile device out there that really properly supports Flash, and Flash for mobile has essentially been discontinued by Adobe, so you're going to have to figure out what's going on there either way.
That's
the same argument as I had earlier. Like, mixing up your content with code, that's what runs you into those kind of problems, right? You've built your content, you've put it inside a runtime, and that runtime is no longer supported, you've got a problem.
Well, and that's where I think it's helpful for us that are in the iOS camp that Android largely doesn't have support from Adobe with Mobile Flash anymore, because you know when Adobe was still pushing that the folks that were trying to push your school to say you need to have an open model, need to go to the Android devices for Flash content, you know, it was hard to explain to them that it may support Flash, but it's terrible. And now you can at least say, no mobile platform supports Flash. So that's not a valid argument anymore.
Yeah. Yep. So that was the main thing I wanted to kind of highlight in this show, was to mention Xamarin and encourage people to go and listen to Ruben's content on that. We'll have a link in the show notes to the iTunes U collection where you can get that. And it is a collection rather than a course. So if you're on a Mac or a PC, you'll be able to download all the material and view it there as well. Other thing I wanted to mention was always to bear in mind that teachers are bombarded with new initiatives all the time. And most of these new initiatives don't last very long. You know, they come and they go. Some are merely fashions. Some are initiatives that are pushed and then people realize that they might not have been the best idea or whatever. Some last a while, but, you know, change is a constant in education, you know. And what's kind of strange about that is that, you know, we haven't changed all that much, but we keep changing it, if you know. The most important thing you can do at a meta level, beyond teaching teachers about, you know, the keyboard or the App Store or Xamarin or lesson planning with one-to-one or whatever, is to give them confidence that this initiative is going to have a long lifespan. And one of the ways that you can do that is by entering into some kind of leasing program for devices. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it. You know, if you're senior management team have got good relationships with the staff and have, you know, strong credibility with the staff, then leadership is essential as well. But another way you can say that is, well, look at the commitment we're making. We're signing a 3-year lease, so this is at least going to be around for 3 years. And that was one of the things I used that when we started our deployment, as a way to give people confidence that there would be several years to follow. And now that we're 3 years into it, we've got to refresh our lease. Where are we going to go? Well, you know, we're going to go iOS again. So now it's going to have been at least a minimum of 6 years that we did this initiative, you know. And teachers are, in my experience, having talked to quite a lot of teachers about this, they're keen to know that this is something kind of for the ages, really. And I think, truth be told, if you do go one-to-one, I don't see many schools, you know, who have done a one-to-one who are no longer doing a one-to-one. And I think it's a bit of a kind of trapdoor upgrade, you know. Once you go through that door, it kind of swings shut behind you, and it's very, very hard to go backwards from that. So the more you can talk about the long term in these projects, the better, I think. That's something that gives teachers confidence to actually invest time and resources, knowing they're going to get a payback. Because teachers typically expect a payback for effort over several years. Because, as you said earlier, Bradley, we teach roughly the same curriculum each year with tweaks, rather than reinventing everything every single year. And I think teachers want to see that they're going to get that kind of payback, you know, a 5x payback, a 10x payback for what they do. And long-term planning is really crucial to that as well. Finally, the last thing I've got on this list here before, we're going to take some listener feedback as well, classroom management techniques. Now, quite often when you get up in front of a group of teachers and talk about one-to-one and so on, a big concern is, how are we going to control the classroom? And I always answer a question with a question and say, well, how do you control the classroom right now? And of course, the answer is some teachers don't control the classroom right now. And I think other teachers do control the classroom perfectly well. But I think what I find with the iPad is it's kind of a magnifying glass, right? So teachers who struggle to control an analog classroom struggle even harder to control a digital classroom. Whereas teachers who control an analog classroom very well get great results because they have that confidence to manage their digital classroom in a certain way. But just some really simple things that you can do to help people along. I think it's really important to specify an iPad case that closes with a cover, right? Because that enables you to stand up in front of a class and say, everybody close your iPads, right? And if you've got cover, you know, cases that don't have a screen cover, then you don't really know that somebody's not got that on somehow. So there's a bit of that. also, just being more mobile around the classroom, the layout of the classroom, there's a lot you can do with that as well. So what some of our teachers have done is they now don't have a front to their classroom. The classroom is arranged in such a way that the teacher can really work from anywhere. And obviously, we talk a lot about Apple TV in the show as well. And that's one of the technologies. Wireless presenting is one of the things that can free a teacher to do more of that, is to move around the classroom a little bit. I'm not saying that's every classroom yet. And, you know, some science classrooms are a little more rigid in their layout and so on, just because of their fixed infrastructure typically. But in general, we're starting to see teachers take that on board, redesign the layout of their classrooms a little bit so that more and more they can be mobile around the classroom. And because you're mobile, that's a classroom management technique as well, because nobody's hiding up the back if there is no back to hide at, you know. So also with the iPad, the more the device is flat, usually flat or slightly inclined on the desk rather than, you know, vertical like a laptop screen would be. So it is actually quite easy to see what a lot of people are doing at one time just by standing up and walking around the classroom. And, you know, teachers know this, right? Teachers know that if you walk up to a kid's desk and something suddenly gets changed, you know, something gets flicked away, something gets turned over or hidden, then you're going to want to just maybe have a wee look in there and see what's going on. Certainly if the iPad's under the desk or if it's being sheltered in some way, that's often a sign that you want to get in there and have a look. So there aren't necessarily, these aren't new techniques, right? You know, these aren't new things that just invented because the iPad came along. These are things that good teachers have done for years and years, and they actually flow very well into an iPad one-to-one. What do you think, Bradley?
No, I agree. And I think this also goes back to not looking for, I'm trying to think of the wording, for digital problems to social issues. So, you know, if you're trying to, you know, just as you can't, you can try to block certain content in your school, but you're never going to be able to block all of it. And so rather than trying to say we always need a technology solution to a social problem, deal with the social problem. So just as if we have a fight at recess one day, doesn't mean we change how recess works or we cancel recess. You deal with the issue. And so if you've got an issue with students, say, so if a parent says, okay, how are we going to keep kids off, you know, keep kids on task in class? Well, you know, that's what the teacher's there for. You know, we don't need to design technology where it locks them down to two websites. You know, yeah. if you are in a situation where you need that, then you've got to deal with the situations directly with the student, not try to fix it in technology. And as you said, if you're walking by and see a student quickly turn off their iPad, well, maybe you just ask. And just as the same way, if they were using a, you know, pen and paper, you know, they could be doodling instead of doing their work. It's kind of the same issue.
Yeah. I mean, at one level, you know, if you take things to extremes, they can become serious problems, right? So, you know, if nobody's ever on task in your classroom, that's a serious problem, right? But the fact that somebody spaced out for 2 minutes over the course of a 6 to 7 hour day in school, is that really the end of the world? You know, I always say to people, like, I went to school in a town called Millport, which is on an island in Scotland, and the schoolhouse there was a very old building. I'm not sure exactly which year. I want to say Victorian, but that's because I don't know anything about architecture. But what is interesting about that building, the room that I spent primary seven in had been built around this era of new technology. And the new technology was considered so distracting for children that they could not be allowed access to it. And as a result, the entire architecture of the building was built around the fact that children could not have access to this new technology. This new technology was called glass, and looking out the window was so distracting for school children that, I'm not even exaggerating here, the windows in the classroom began 8 feet off the ground. A very, very tall building, basically a double-story classroom, very high ceiling, and the windows, all you could see was the sky and the tops of the trees. You could not see anything that happened outside the classroom. Because that was considered a classroom distraction, was putting a window in the classroom. So this is not a new problem. You know, it's not something that just showed up because the iPad showed up in school. it's definitely something that's been there as long as kids have been told to do, sit down and do things instead of just doing what they want to do.
Well, and let's be honest, how many of those in the workplace don't space out for 10 minutes here and there? I mean, I'm going to be honest, when I came back from lunch today, I came back with a stack, a folder full of like 10 manuals for my appliances. I took 10 minutes of time I was technically supposed to be working and Googled those and found the PDFs and put them into Evernote. You know, we all do it. We all space out or goof off for 10 to 20 minutes at a time. And, you know, again, you got to keep kids on task, but to think that they're going to come in and only think about school from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. is not realistic.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, we bite into their evenings as well. So, you know, we can cut them a little slack during the day as well.
Yeah, and that's the reason I do that. That's the reason I did that and did after lunch and didn't feel bad, because I will, you know, often, you know, take a work phone call after hours from my boss. So I figure if I'm going to take 10 minutes to talk to him at night, then if I don't take 10 minutes after lunch to download some PDFs, then it all evens out.
Yeah. You want to do a little bit of listener feedback, Bradley?
Yeah, it sounds great. Got some things that have collected here. Just so you know that if you email us, we always read it, you know, usually within a day, but we just kind of let those collect unless it's urgent, and so we can kind of answer them on the show. Because if we just email you back you directly, generally, then not everybody else gets to take advantage of that information.
Okay, so first question comes from Ryan Williamson. He says, I finished a six-week trial where one of my classes all had iPads. I found the technology stuff was much less challenging than the curriculum aspect, particularly because I was teaching an AP class with a set curriculum. I found it difficult to give the students the freedom that the iPads enable. I'd love to hear your take on approaching that aspect of things. Well, I guess I feel we've kind of covered that a little bit by introducing Sammer in this show. And I think what I would encourage Ryan or anybody in a similar situation to do is to listen to Ruben's presentations and think about what you can do just to substitute to start with. Can you substitute, you know, something very simple, like, you know, if you're teaching chemistry, you're timing an experiment, let's substitute a physical stopwatch for the clock app on the iPad. Start there and then look at what you can do to take the next step and the next step and the next step. So it's, you know, I know with a six-week trial, it's quite difficult to take your time on that. You've got to kind of show some pretty good results pretty quickly. But, you know, as part of a longer planning process, you can certainly use that and say, well, you know, be aware that you're substituting, but also be aware that's okay. But then, you know, take it from there and take the next step and so on. We got a question about a book you referred to, Bradley, a few shows ago, which was called The Something of Something. Can you fill us in on what that was called again?
Yeah, I think I even referred to it as The Value of a Skint Knee, and I was sort of wrong. It's actually called The Blessing of a Skint Knee. It's by a lady named Wendy Mogul. It's talking about letting your kids fail and the value of that. And I'll have a link to the Amazon link in the show notes to that. We've actually had her in. She spoke to our parents before. And so if you're interested in bringing her in as a speaker, highly recommend her.
Excellent. Yeah, I can definitely recommend doing that, you know, bringing people in who have some experience. If you have a school near you who have used iPads or have some experience, then, you know, ask if somebody will come and talk to your parents as well. I've certainly done that for several schools across the UK, and happy to do that for other schools as well if I can help. But you may have somebody a little more local to you. I'm aware that traveling to a school in New Zealand might not be the most practical thing for me, and my wife might not be so happy with it either, even though I would love to visit New Zealand one day, but it is a long way away for a parents' night.
Yeah, we do usually either once a year or twice a school year these things called parent seminars. So teachers kind of rotate teaching classes to the parents at night. So one of the classes I usually teach is about our student information system and kind of navigating that. And then our second grade teacher might do a class on how to help your kids with their homework. So you're helping them learn but not doing it for them and things like that. And we look at that as much as a good PR opportunity that we can actually get in front of our parents and talk to them. When it's not about their kids' grades or late tuition payments, but just so we can get together and just to talk. And it's been very helpful for us.
Yeah, that's definitely a good tactic. Before you have those evenings, try and take, if you're talking about going in a one-to-one project, try and take the temperature informally of as many parents as you can before you get them all in a room together, because that can sometimes just be a... I've seen it descend into just a sequence of complaints, some very unrelated to technology, you know, just malcontent people coming along and having their say in front of other people, which is something that can happen as well. So you want to go into those things prepared. But definitely, you know, talking is... you can't over-communicate when you do these things. That's really important.
Yeah, we're going through our accreditation process right now, and I actually had to print out a 300-page PDF today. I was very saddened. I did do front and back, but I was still very saddened that every classroom, you know, basically wrote their curriculum down according to the standards, and we had to combine them. So they sent them to me in Word, and then so I went through and corrected the spacing and made the font uniformed, and then I converted them to PDF, and then I used PDF Pen Pro to kind of combine them together. And it was pretty neat. It was like 300 pages, but it was only 3 megabytes. And so I printed it off front and back, and it was like a book. But now we have to go through that with a red pen and mark it up again, and then I have to correct it again. Very fun.
Good times.
Yeah, thankful for PDF Pen Pro.
Yeah. Okay. Next question comes from David Parr. And he says, in your discussions about services like iTunes U, Moodle, Evernote, etc., I haven't heard you mention Apple's own Wiki server, which we use considerably. I was wondering what your thoughts were regarding Apple's server. Now, obviously, Wiki server is a component of Mac OS X server, which is itself a component that you can add on to Mac OS X. Used to be, in times past, that OS X server was a completely separate product, a separate OS installation that you would get, and it would cost, you know, substantially more than Mac OS X, and you'd run that on a machine. But today what you can do is you can actually turn any Mac OS X, or excuse me, OS X Mac into a server just by downloading the server package from the App Store and installing it. And it's pretty cheap. I think it's about, certainly over here, it's about £13, $19 or something, Bradley, I'm not sure. But it's pretty cheap. It's certainly a cheap way to go.
Yeah, it's I think, I want to say it's $19 here as well.
Yeah. Have you run Wiki server in your school, Bradley?
I have not.
No, I haven't either. I've used it. I've experimented with it, but I have not deployed it personally. And I guess one of the reasons I haven't deployed it is because of my kind of increasing disinclination to run services inside the school. That if I need a Wiki of some kind, I would initially look for some kind of hosted service or something that I could use rather than running it myself in the school. What I have noticed about Wiki server, there's a couple of things that are quite interesting about it. Because it's running on an OS X server, and if that machine provides your Active Directory passwords or your Open Directory passwords for your network, then you can actually integrate those two authentication schemes, so you can have the users that are named on your server have access to, you know, private wikis and blogs and so on and things like that. It has definitely gotten better over recent times. I haven't looked at it recently, but I think it was 10.7.2, obviously, which is a bit of a while ago now, but prior to that version of OS X server, you couldn't do certain things from the iPad that you might want to do. For example, you couldn't edit wiki pages from an iOS device. You can do all that kind of stuff now, and I think it has some capabilities for uploading things to the wiki as well, although it doesn't support things like sending file attachments by email, which Evernote supports, and Basecamp supports as well, which is a good way to get very varied content off your iOS device and onto the Wiki server. But I think there are some features for uploading certain other kinds of content.
Hey, speaking of Basecamp, I want to say I saw a tweet last week about signups for a beta of their official iOS app. So I guess that may be coming.
Interesting.
I signed up, I think, but I don't know, because we're going through a project with a vendor right now using Basecamp, and I was hoping to get an iOS app, so we shall see.
Yeah, they did just announce Basecamp Personal, which doesn't help with iOS users, but it's instead of having to kind of have a hosted account that, you know, you can make multiple projects, you can just buy like a one-off project for, I think it's one-time fee of $25, so you can start to use that. But as for Wiki server, I haven't used it a lot myself. I do know of there are some schools that do use it, and they have been able to build a pretty extensive collaboration system around that. but I haven't heard about that from schools that are as kind of pure iOS as Cedars is, for example. A lot of the schools that I've seen use Wikiserver effectively, yes, they're using iOS, but they also have substantial access to Macs as well that helps them to do the more complicated tasks on Wikiserver. So it's not something I dislike. I don't have any particular problem with it. It's just that my personal philosophy about services like that is that I don't want to really run them myself if I don't have to.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat. And just from a security perspective, for me, it allows me to keep my firewall even more locked down for when people are trying to access it from home. Yeah, I don't have to. I'm not having to try to let them back in our firewall. We overhauled our camera system, as I'm sure a lot of schools have done after the school shootings, and just getting those things to work properly from offsite were a lot of fun. Thankfully, we found a nice, well, I don't want to say nice iOS app. We found an iOS app that would integrate with the DVR, but it's not updated for iOS or iPhone 5, and that very much concerns me.
Yep. But. Okay. Last point, it's not so much a question as a suggestion. I think it's a great one. Is Ian Stoba suggests that a possible topic for a future show might be the use of iPad in special education. And he's absolutely right. I think it's, over time, I'm finding that the iPad is pushing it, and Apple is pushing it an open door with iPad into special educational needs. And partly that's because, obviously, for kids that are physically challenged or educationally challenged, they are already spending a lot of money on assistive devices for children. For example, you know, children with communication problems, some of the specialized devices that they use to help them communicate, those are very, very expensive. And even buying like a $200 app and an iPad, you're still making a massive saving over buying bespoke equipment to help those children. So in large part, there's obviously, this has been highlighted in even in Apple keynotes. You know, Tim Cook has, there's been references to special education in Apple keynotes as well. And I think it's definitely something that we should explore probably over a couple of shows. And I can think of a couple of people that we could maybe bring on the show to say a bit more about that, because it's not my area of expertise at all in education, far from it. And I don't want to just talk off the top of my head on that subject. I think it deserves serious consideration from people who are experts. And I think we'll try and see if we can line up some people that we know to come on the show and talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think that's important. You know, you and I, while we feel like we do know a lot, there are a lot of aspects of you know, education that I am clueless on. And so it's always helpful to bring on experts who have done this rather than just us talk about it from a technical application. Let's see how it's done in the classroom and how, let's look at the results as well.
We had a number of visitors in the school recently from a local high school that specializes in helping kids with those kind of support needs. And one of the things that she said to me was that the golden ticket, if you like, the key to doing this kind of work was personalizing whatever you do for each individual child, because everybody's difficulties and needs are different and sometimes are complex as well. It's not just one issue. It can be multiple. And she said that what she had found is that the iPad had been so flexible that she could adapt that device to any set of needs that she was presented with by any student in her school. And that was what the thing that kind of had attracted her to it and had made her such a kind of keen user of the iPad herself. And she was there to just kind of hear from us a little bit and also share, because we learned a lot from her that day as well. And it was really good to make that contact. So yeah, it's a big topic. It's certainly a very worthy topic. And it's something that I think is certainly relevant to the show as well. So we should definitely try and pull some people in on that one as well. That's all our feedback for just now. We'd love to hear any more that you have. Drop us an email through our contact form on the website, outofschool.net. If you have any other feedback for the show, the other big feedback we got was, could we speak a bit louder? We're trying. We're amateur podcasters. We're turning everything up to 11 for you, and we'll do our best to keep it as noisy as we can in your car. We've heard that feedback, and we're trying to work on that. And apart from that, that's your show for this week. So I'm Fraser Spears, spears.org on the web, Fraser Spears on Twitter. Bradley, where can people find you?
Chambersdaily.com and at Bradley Chambers on Twitter and app.net. Lots of, you know, we always love hearing feedback from you guys, even if it's just a, hey, we appreciate the show. It's always nice to know when we put the effort into recording the show that people are getting something out of it. I've gotten quite a few email from folks, you know, planning deployments, and they said, hey, you know, using this as a resource to send to my headmaster. And so those are always great to hear.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks again to our sponsors, BDocs and oh, I'm blanking on the last guy.
Mind Vault.
I was going to say Vault. That's not correct.
You could use Mind Vault to memorize the sponsor names.
Yeah, I should totally be doing that. It's, for shame. For shame. I was going to say File Vault there. That's that.
Yeah, that would,
Apple's,
I guess,
disk encryption technology.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, great show. Thanks for everybody for listening in, and we'll see you next week.